Well, last week at this time, sitting in the congregation listening to Mr. Bill Bradford, I was quite certain I knew what I would be speaking on today. And 2 minutes into the sermon, I realized that, well, good themes go around because Mr. Bradford did pretty much the topic I was going to talk about today, which is hupomone or endurance or persistence and staying in there. And I felt that while maybe I could add some things and perhaps a little nuance or some ideas to it, that it probably wouldn't be good to give it again so close to last week. So with that, I have been asked to speak a split sermon at the feast. And this year, we're very, very delighted to have the chance to be going to Hong Kong, China. I know many decades ago there were feasts held there by the Church of God, but this is quite a first that about 100 brethren will be there, of whom I believe there are 10 church members in Hong Kong, and so it's really quite an extraordinary opportunity, and we're really very much looking forward to that. And in light of that, I have a message which I hope you'll find rather interesting today, but it wouldn't normally be in the context of actually being in Hong Kong and talking about things which are more related to that sphere. But I hope to relate it in such a way that you'll see that this actually is a message that fits rather well with the Feast of Tabernacles. So China, of course, in the news constantly. We know that just within the matter of the last few weeks, perhaps not everyone realizes this, the largest Russian-Chinese naval operation in the history of those two countries took place. It was a massive military operation. And in fact, just within the past week, Chinese military ships came within 12 nautical miles of U.S. land. They were just off the Aleutians, and that is the first time that has happened to my knowledge, that actually warships of the Japanese naval fleet were in close proximity to American soil. So clearly testing the waters, as it were, testing to see what the response might be. So we know as well, just on a kind of a basic level, that the Chinese products are flooding our marketplace. In fact, you might have a pen, you might have clothes, you might have something in your car that is Chinese made. And in fact, it might be kind of surprising if you didn't have something that was Chinese made. Living without Chinese products these days is almost well nigh impossible to do. So the Chinese people really, they're in the background. We hear about them in the news. We may not think very much about them. But who are the Chinese people? 50 years ago, there were 700 million, not a small number. But today, in 2015, at this moment, there are 1.4 billion Chinese people. So I wondered if we have a good grasp of what a billion is. And as we often do, we Google and say, well, how can I imagine a billion? So I thought this might be interesting. Think in terms of a billion, that a billion minutes ago, the Roman Empire was in full swing. That's about 1,900 years. A billion hours ago, it was the Stone Age, about 114,000 years ago. A billion months ago, dinosaurs were walking the planet. So billion is a massively large number. For those of you a little more visual, if you took a tightly packed stack of new $1,000 bills and stacked them up, totaling $1 billion, it would be 63 miles high. Jets fly at approximately 5 to 7 miles high. But that stack of bills, of $1,000 bills, if you have a billion of them, would be stacked that high. So let's go back to who are the Chinese people. Noah, of course, had three sons, and one of them, Japheth, is believed to be the father of the Oriental races. Now, we may as well turn over to it, and it's in Genesis chapter 10. We see some of the lineage, names that we don't hear very often, but were the beginnings of the dispersion of the human race. Genesis 10, and verses 2 to 5, we won't necessarily go through all of it, but the sons of Japheth, continue on, were Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshach, and Tiras. And just as an aside, some of those names could be related to other Asian, both nations and cities. The sons of Gomer, etc. And verse 5, from there the coastlands, peoples of the Gentiles, were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, and according to their nations. So God is the one who separates out into different nations. Now, a little deeper into it, I was able to look up information from several different sources, one of which was Dr. Hayes' compendium of world history. And he says, everyone owes a great deal of respect to the Chinese nation for being the only people whose chronological records were preserved without need of restoration from the time of Babel till now. The history of the nation is found in Shu King, which literally means the canon of history. So the Chinese are tremendous record keepers, and that goes back many millennia. Now, it's supposed that they originally migrated from a site in Mesopotamia. Forgive me, it's a little bit dry. This might seem more like something John May would come out, his background in history. But nevertheless, this is where we record the histories of the nations. So they migrated from Mesopotamia, showing evidence of similarity to the Babylonian and the Assyrian culture in their arts, sciences, and government. The approximate date of their origin, 2500 BC, surprisingly close to the strict chronological datings we have of that great event, the Tower of Babel, which resulted in the division of all mankind into new linguistic groups and the consequent dispersion of these peoples around the face of the earth. If God at that time truly confused these mother tongues of earth, these people carried with them a newly acquired spoken language. Now, it's very interesting that there seem to be two major divisions of the Chinese language, the Mandarin dialect and the Cantonese dialect. However, it may not be well known, there are numerous other dialects which are mutually unintelligible. To the best of my knowledge, the Mandarin language, the Chinese, and the Cantonese language, they cannot speak to each other. It's not as close as, say, Portuguese and Spanish, which has a great deal of similarity. Rather, they are so entirely different that they cannot even have a conversation with one another. However, the exception is that their written language unifies the entire nation of China, that whether from north to south, east to west, they have the same orthography. And that is their unifying factor. Anyone in China can read a Chinese newspaper with full understanding without having to know what the pronunciation of the words are. Now, I bring that up as background because it figures very much into the hearts of the message that I'm going to be giving, because we ought to know very much about these people, the Chinese, not merely because they constitute 1.4 billion people, although that's an amazing fact in this end time period we're in, but because the God of the Old Testament is the same today, yesterday, and forever. And whether it's a Christian, Jew, Muslim, or Buddhist, whether it's a Shintoist, a Confucianist, a Taoist, or an atheist under the communist rule currently in China, that his plan or design is to bring salvation to all peoples, of whom today one in five is Chinese. So we're going to learn in this message that the very language of the Chinese people may convict them of the truth of the Bible as being God's inspired instruction book to mankind. So for a title, and I know that that this is very important to say it clearly, the title is simply Genesis and the Chinese. Now, I owe a debt of gratitude to an author named C. Kang, K-A-N-G, who wrote a book called The Discovery of Genesis, How the Truths of Genesis Were Found Hidden in the Chinese Language. And this author, Kang, who wrote the book, reminds us that China boasts four millennia of unbroken civilization. And the ancient Chinese were monotheists, serving one supreme heavenly ruler called Shang Ti. We'll return to that near the end. So it's not out of the question that the ancient beliefs reach back to the worship of the one true God, the God that we worship as well. And this book represents a startling theological discovery. Now, I had heard rumors of this way back in the 80s when I was going to Ambassador College, and I finally was able to find a copy. It's now out of print, although it is possible to find used copies of it on Amazon. And looking at it, the parallels that this author is able to draw by taking the Chinese writing characters, dissecting them, analyzing them in the light of the chapters of Genesis, the parallels that we find with the Genesis account are truly startling. And yet this man was challenged, and this is in the preface to his own book. He was challenged, and by the way, background is that he was a man of Chinese descent living in Singapore, and he was a Christian minister. So one day he was preaching, and out of the blue it seems that a woman came up to him and challenged him, said, well, these are very fine fairy tales for children. He had been preaching the Bible. So they're for children, but they're hardly worth the time of an adult. She proceeded to let him know that, in her opinion, educated people believed the evolutionary theory explained origins. Now, this man felt very challenged, and he went on to, as I said, dissect the Chinese writing system. And some of the points he makes, I believe, are very interesting. The geographical isolation of China is such that because of mountain ranges, because of deserts, because of oceans, this race of people was sealed off to itself. I had the great pleasure of actually going to China in 1985 on one of the AICF programs, studying the Chinese language for a mere 6 weeks, and at that time seeing what was called the Forbidden City. And I still remember I had an opportunity to take a photograph in front of one of the massive palaces, probably approximately four times the size of this building, and I was all alone. Someone took a picture of me. I was all alone. There was no one else around in the vicinity whatsoever because only tourists were being allowed into the Forbidden City at that time. So because these people were so sealed off by these geographic influences, as a result, their culture is very unique, and it had been left alone for some two millennia. So these Chinese, very early in their history as a very separate people, had to find a way to communicate with a written language, a system of word pictures, and I'm sure some of this is familiar to you, to communicate. Now, these word pictures had to be invented with in mind the peoples of the ancient world, and so it had to start with very simple format, as I'll explain in just a few moments. Because with all primitive languages, you start with pictographs, small pictures that represent objects. But the problem with this is once you get past things like trees, stones, mountains, and streams, how do you represent abstract concepts, love, fidelity, loyalty, government? Well, it's through the combination of the elements that this takes place. So these ideograms or picture stories of necessity had to contain common knowledge in order to be understood. It would have been natural to use as a basis some of the ideograms from the history of their own people. And so the ancient beginnings of humanity found their way into this first orthography of the Chinese. And consequently, the written Chinese language is composed of characters uniquely adapted to the possibility of containing the stories of Genesis. Now, it took some time to get to it, but I put an SPS in my notes, and that is that the written Chinese orthography may one day be our tool to reach and convict the Chinese people of the truth of the Bible, that they have had with them through the millennia some of the basic understandings from the book of Genesis. And with that, with a little help from Mr. Kelness, who is going to set me up, we're going to see exactly what that pertains to. All right, so with that, I've titled this simply Genesis and the Chinese Writing Characters. So to give a very, very brief background, the simple objects will sometimes represent rather simple things, such as mountains. You've probably heard of Fujiyama, the most famous volcano in the world in Japan. Well, yama simply means mountain. And you can see from the pictograph, it actually looks similar to a mountain. Now, I'm going to give an aside that some of these pronunciations are actually from the Japanese language. And the aside is that the Japanese people use the Chinese writing characters because before about 500 AD, they didn't have a written system. So they actually adopted the written system, apparently because of Christian missionaries, rather, that came from China into Japan. And so that's why the Japanese will have many of the same symbols that I'll be talking about today. So for my own use, I put in Japanese pronunciation because it's a language I'm familiar with. So the second character, you can imagine the picture of a person with the two legs. So this is the simple pictogram that later can be combined into other characters. And then just one more, the character of person. Then if you imagine a person with his arms outspread, this represents the concept of big, or as pronounced as dai or large. So let's start with something very basic, and that is that this character, ta or tambo, would be considered a plot of ground, a place where agricultural products are grown. Could be a rice field, but one might also think of it as a garden. So this character then representing a garden, a place of growing crops. So the next one is much more complex. And this character actually means to create. So now we have to dissect the character to understand the meaning of it. You see the box in the center is representative of a mouth, and a mouth represents a person, one who may speak. Just above that, with the cross and the base underneath it, that is ground. That is a piece of land, dirt or soil, or if you will, a piece of dust. Then you have next to it the character that starts on the left, on your left, and then comes down, sweeps down underneath it. This suggests movement. So in other words, you have a person represented by the mouth and moving, and also together with land or dust or mud, if you will. And finally, the small character, which is the one that is represented by a tiny stroke just to the left of the plus sign. This one is actually referring to making into action or bringing into action. So this is the character that is used to say create. And we see here the possibility that we have the creation of the first man who was taken from the earth and given the ability to move. Let's continue on. This character, again, contains two characters we've seen already. The first of these is the plot of land, the agricultural land, or if you will, a garden. Just above that, again, is the character meaning a mouth and representing a person. So we have a garden, we have a person, and above that, the single stroke represents the letter one. Whereas we do it vertically in the Chinese language, it's simply horizontal. You have a horizontal stroke meaning one. Now, the character to the left of that is actually one that represents divinity or God. So it seems like here we have a very interesting story contained within the character of the first person in a garden spoken to by God. Now, here's where it becomes very interesting. The meaning of this character is happiness or blessing. What greater blessing from God to man to put him into this beautiful, luxuriant garden where he sees foliage of every color, flowers, fruit-bearing trees surrounding him, and what other more blissful place could you imagine than this? And this means happiness, once again, happiness or blessing. Now we build the story going on to the third character. This character can be pronounced as Qin. And with this character, the bottom portion that's in blue, I was able to find a place where I actually divided up into colors. And, but you're all green, aren't you? Sorry about that. My screen has blue. So the lower character represents God. It's God. And the two upper characters, I think you can probably cipher out. We have two trees. So we have two trees as well as God. And the meaning of this character is to prohibit or forbid. So what does this seem to tell us? That there's a command or a divine command going from a God about two trees. And it seems like a choice would have to be made between them. And the choice would be, will you choose one tree or the other? Now, without trying to read too much into it, it does seem to correspond to and parallel the commands that God gave to our forebears, Adam and Eve, saying that there's a distinction between these two trees. So, with that in mind, that there is an admonition, or if you could say a forbidding of one of the trees to be eaten, we next come to a very interesting character, which could be translated as greed, sometimes avaricious, and you'll recognize immediately that there are two trees, and that under the two trees is the symbol which represents a woman, if you will, imagining a woman carrying a child, rather a stylized version, but that's how they developed over time. So then we have greed with a woman and two trees. So we have to ask the question, is this just happenstance that the word for greed or an unholy or a forbidden desire would contain two trees plus a woman? Because the biblical record says, when the woman saw the trees were good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and the tree to be desired to make one wise, she took the fruit and ate of it. And it was the woman, not the man, but rather the woman first who desired the fruit of the forbidden tree. So this seems to be, to a degree, a test of their loyalty and understanding of God's command. So jumping down a little bit, as a test of loyalty, we could ascertain whether or not the human family was going to go in one direction or the other. Which would they choose? Would they choose to not eat of the tree and so that they could eat of the tree of life, or would they take of it? So, of course, it turned out to be a test. Now, there is one other character that I'm sure that you can guess coming next. The other character is the devil. And this is actually the symbol for the devil. Now, it takes some breaking down because it has various parts. So after you look at it for just a moment, I'm going to go to the next screen, which actually breaks it down a little bit farther, I believe, because one of the characters is rather tiny, rather small and inset. You might see it as three, almost looking like a small triangle. And it divides up into these parts. So we have, first of all, that a person is, I actually got two of them mixed up. Oh, I just realized that. Okay, so I'm going to have to fix that. Actually, we should switch to the word secret and person, because the first one, person, is a picture of two legs, another stylized version of a person walking. The next one, the one that looks a little bit like a triangle, is actually the one for secret, so my apologies. And then we have, again, once more, the garden. Now, why would that be, after all? Why would the Chinese decide to represent the devil with these particular three characters? I do not think it would be coincidence. It seems unlikely. But it does get actually even more interesting, because then we have in our next slide something a little bit more complete, and this represents a demon as well. Notice the characters that have been added. So we started with the secret person in a garden. Now we've added two trees as well, and we have kind of a covering. So you can imagine that Satan waiting under the camouflage of the two trees as Eve is coming into the garden speaks to her, and this is very, very subtle, because just above the grid of four squares, which represents the garden, there's a very tiny stroke, and that tiny stroke represents actually an action. So an action was taken in the garden, which was to entice, if you will, to seduce Eve, to ask her if she would like to take advantage of this fruit, and of course she did. So this, as it's called, the devil radical is placed under the cover of protecting trees, waiting for Eve to pass by the forbidden tree, at which time he would be testing her loyalty. And it is truly amazing that uniting all of these primitive pictographs for a garden, for a tree, for a walking person, that putting them together, it was almost unbelievable that together they are in the Chinese language also be translated as tempting or tempter. So these six small characters come together to create the fairly high-level concept of tempting. Isn't that amazing? So I hope that by now you've actually recognized there is such an uncanny resemblance with the creation of story as it's related in the Word of God. That is the book of Genesis. Now, coming to the end of this story, that China proudly claims the distinction of 4,500 years of unbroken civilization. But can it be possible that in China we find evidence of the book of Genesis? Who would consider this country? Its religious mixture of ancestor worship, Taoism with myths and magic, and its superstitions and divinations, Confucianism, scholarly teachings, who would have thought we could find it as the depository of something we would recognize as distinctly Judeo-Christian? So I'll end with one more character, and without going into the various meanings of it, this character pronounced Shangti was the god of the ancient Chinese, and they called this god Heavenly Emperor. And I thought that I would read something that was related to what may be a description, and I would not necessarily say it rises to the point of scripture, but this is how the Chinese speak of Shangti. And then we're going to return to the Bible to find how does this really overlap with what our role is as Christians. So they write of Shangti, of old in the beginning there was the great chaos without form and dark. The five elements had not begun to revolve, nor the sun and the moon to shine. In the midst thereof there existed neither form nor sound. Thou, spiritual sovereign, came forth in your presidency and first to divide the grosser parts from the purer. You made heaven, you made earth, you made man, all things and their reproducing power got their being from you. The heavenly ruler is praised for his loving kindness, and the ceremony concludes with this: Thy sovereign goodness is infinite. Could we say those words of our God? Thy goodness is infinite. As a potter, you made all living things. Your sovereign goodness is infinite. Great and small are sheltered by your love. As engraven on the heart of your poor servant is the sense of your goodness, so that my feeling cannot be fully displayed. Sounds almost like a psalmist. With great kindness you did bear with us, and notwithstanding our demerits, you grant us life and prosperity. So we're ending the story then of what I call a Chinese tale. And let's go back to the book of Acts as a conclusion, because I believe there is a very unique parallel. I'm just going to shut this down for now. And the parallel is what Paul found in the book of Acts in chapter 17. That Paul found himself amongst the heathen people, a people beset by idolatry, a people that he knew he was required to meet and to tell them of the gospel truth. But this was a challenge. How was he to reach them? What would be the inn that he would find? So, Acts 17, starting in verse 16, we read that now while Paul waited for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him when he saw the city was given over to idols. The city was rife with idols of all sorts. Therefore, he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and with the Gentile worshipers, and in the marketplace daily with them who happened to be there. So these were a people who were willing to discuss. Verse 18, then a certain Epicurean and Stoic philosopher encountered him, and some said, what does this babbler want to say? Rather similar to the woman who said, why do you tell us fairy tales? Others said, oh, he seems to be a proclaimer of foreign gods, because he preached to them Jesus and the resurrection. Verse 19, they took him, brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new doctrine is of which you speak, for you're bringing some strange things to our ears. Therefore, we want to know what these things mean. For all the Athenians and the foreigners who were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. Sounds rather like our society today. Just tell us something new. Verse 22, then Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious. For as I was passing through and considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. They wanted to cover all their bases. Therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing, him I proclaim to you. God, who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life, breath, and all things. And he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings. I think particularly apropos in light of what we've said about China and the role it will surely play in the very near future. Verse 27, so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far off from each one of us. And what I hoped in this message was to show that perhaps the Chinese may one day recognize that their hope was with them throughout their history, written in their own language and hidden from their own eyes, that the stories of Genesis were actually found in the Chinese writing characters.